From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And let's get right to Florida, where some facilities for the elderly across the state are being evacuated after 8 elderly people in a nursing home in Hollywood, Florida, died. The rehabilitation center at Hollywood Hills had electricity, but a tree felled by Irma took out the transformer that ran the air conditioning. Starting at 3 a.m. Wednesday morning, staffers began sending patients in distress to the fully operational hospital just across the street. By the third patient at 5 a.m., the hospital staff became alarmed and crossed the street to find the nursing home an oven with several more deceased patients inside. AP reporter Terry Spencer joins us on his cell phone. He's covering this. Terry, you spoke to a staffer at the home who wasn't there overnight Wednesday in the morning, but was there Tuesday after air conditioning failed. What did he tell you?
Well, the gentleman was the name of Paul Byrne Bogle. He was a member of the housekeeping staff. He said after the air conditioning had failed, the staff used fans, put cold towels, ice on the patients, gave them cold drinks. We learned later that there were also portable air conditioners inside the facility. He thought it was manageable.
Right. But it's so interesting that they had these spot coolers from the hospital. In fact, the rehab center had reportedly been called by regulators on Tuesday afternoon. I don't know if they were doing a regular check. But they reported at that time that they had these spot coolers and fans.
Right. They indicated to the state that there weren't no issues.
Well, and the New York Times is reporting that state health officials told the home's administrators to call 911 if they believed patients' health was at risk. Look, you know, what are the big questions for you about this? Maybe they didn't call 911, but they certainly started sending patients across the street.
Well, that was the question, is if the temperatures were getting so out of hand, they are across a residential street from Memorial Regional Hospital, which is a trauma center. It would have been very simple to send somebody across the street, say, hey, we're having an emergency here. Can we bring our people across the street? And they would have been accommodated.
Well, and you looked into the status of this particular nursing home. There are regulations. There are inspections. There are drills. How did this home fare?
Well, there was a county rating system that gave it 2 out of 5 stars. There were no complaints, however, that we found at the state level against this facility. But at this point, it's really hard to say what the reputation of the facility is at this point. We're still looking into that.
Well, we're hearing, at least anecdotally, there's a woman who's appeared on CNN who pulled her mother out of the facility last week as Irma was bearing down because she didn't feel that her mother was getting the attention she needed. But this is a tricky slope because nursing homes are charged with an incredible endeavor taking care of the failing. And you know, there's often dispute as to whether or not they are giving the care that a loved one would want. But as to the requirements by the state and federal law, this nursing home was compliant, right, in filing an emergency plan?
They filed an emergency plan with the county as they're required. It got approved. How much the county actually goes and checks to see whether what's on paper matches reality, that's another question. The fire chief did say last night that they've had 127 calls to the rehabilitation center over the last year, which he called excessive.
But still, they filed the emergency plan, and we understand held a hurricane drill in October.
Correct. They had a hurricane drill. It was a 1 hour or so tabletop drill, and they gave themselves flying colors.
Well, they gave themselves flying colors. Look, what's happening now with the state?
The state has closed the facility, although all the patients have been evacuated already. The police are doing a criminal investigation into what happened there. They've not ruled out anything, whether it was heat or could it have been carbon monoxide that was contributing from the generators. They're trying to find out who was there, who ordered what. Were the employees trying to do something and were being countermanded by superiors? Those are all the kinds of questions that they're going to be asking.
Well, I'm wondering if county officials are also asking themselves how they should have responded to Florida Power and Light. They held a news conference Wednesday. This is the power company. They say they met in March with Broward County officials to talk about hurricane prep and to ask which facilities would be top tier, should be flagged as being critical infrastructure that would need power first. The hospital across the street was flagged, but the nursing home was not.
Correct. But I don't think that gets the nursing home off the hook necessarily, and I don't think other people do. There was no weather situation that would have prevented them, no flooding, no rain, no anything that would have prevented them from taking those people across the street yesterday when the temperatures got that hot.
Yeah. That's Terry Spencer of the AP. Terry, I know you'll stay on this story. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
President Trump confirmed today that he is working on a deal on DACA, which shields young people brought to the country illegally from deportation. The president met with Democrats about the issue last night. Now, when a person is in the country illegally, marrying a U.S. citizen is one way they can obtain a green card. But because of changes in immigration policy, getting married may no longer be a path to legal status. Some immigrants who are coming out of the shadows as spouses of U.S. citizens are winding up in jail, as Laura Benchoff of member station WHYY reports.
Marriage tests couples in any number of ways. Lily Williams and Jonathan Palacios, both in their late 20s, have just spent about an hour getting quizzed, literally, on their relationship. Standing outside a gray federal building in West Philadelphia, they say U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services asked them everything from the date they were married to the name of their cat.
Even though I know everything, for some reason I got in the interview and I couldn't remember any of the dates. So, like, I usually get mad at him for not knowing the dates.
Williams and Palacios have been together for 7 years and married for two. Palacios is undocumented. He left Honduras when he was 16 and crossed the border illegally. Late last year, they began the process of bringing him out of the shadows, filing what's called a petition for an alien relative. This interview is one of their last steps to getting a green card application approved. Pulling out a fat blue accordion folder, Williams leafs through all of the evidence that they brought.
This is like our tickets from our honeymoon, from like the hotel and everything.
Then Williams comes across a stack of stationery.
Yeah, these are letters I sent to him while I was in York.
She's talking about a prison in York County, Pennsylvania, that also houses immigrants the federal government is planning to deport. One morning in early May, immigration officers showed up outside the couple's home in Haverford, Pennsylvania, around the time Palacios heads to work at a local restaurant. They surrounded his car and arrested him. It's not clear how Immigration and Customs Enforcement found Palacios. ICE declined an interview, but a spokesman said in a statement that the office does sometimes get information from the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service. That's the part of DHS that processes requests to change your immigration status after you marry a U.S. citizen. So far, arrests like Palacios are not a huge trend. WHYY has confirmed three cases with ties to the Philadelphia area where ICE arrested a person after they came forward as the spouse of a U.S. citizen. Compare that to the first 3 months of the year, when more than 1,000 people in Pennsylvania filed family petitions. But it is a change, says William Stock, a local attorney and former president of the American Immigration Lawyers Association.
Previously, if a person was filing that petition, it was very often the first step to getting themselves on the road back to legal. And the Immigration Service would very often look at that situation and say, well, look, I mean, if you're on the road to legal, let's not make you a priority.
A priority for deportation. That was under President Obama. Now, says Stock, immigration officers are obliged to arrest anyone they come across under executive orders signed by President Donald Trump.
Does this person have a U.S. citizen relative? Does this person have U.S. citizen children? Does this person have a job or a business that they run? None of those things matter. Everyone is a priority for removal.
Palacios does have one black mark on his immigration record that gives immigration authorities the right to deport him quickly. When he was 18, he missed a hearing with an immigration judge in Philadelphia. While that doesn't sound like a big deal, local immigration attorney Brennan Giangrasso says it carries a stiff penalty under U.S. immigration law.
It's pretty unforgiving. You can't miss a court date in immigration court. If you miss a court date, you're ordered removed.
This April, one of Giangrasso's clients found himself in nearly the same situation as Palacios. He reads some details from that man's file.
They got married in 2015, so he's been married for just over 2 years. And he has a son who is 2.5.
That man, who didn't give his attorney permission to use his name, had, like Palacios, also missed an immigration hearing and is still in York County prison. Giangrasso says this has not happened to one of his clients before, and it makes him pause. He says he would still advise future clients to try to change their status, but to proceed with caution.
If you're going in with your eyes open, that's the most important thing, is really that the client is well informed about the risks.
That now include potential arrest and deportation. Back in West Philadelphia, Palacios says spending 5 weeks in detention was really hard. He and Williams debated moving to Honduras just to free him. But Palacios wanted to stick it out, and because he has a good case to stay here as the spouse of a citizen, a judge released him in June. Now he says dealing with immigration is less scary.
It doesn't feel painful to do anything. It's like normal stuff. It's better than being where I was. So,
he was mad at me for being nervous because he was like, look, I went through a lot worse than this. We can take an interview.
After all, they faced a much more difficult test when Palacios was behind bars. For Here and Now, I'm Laura Benshoff.
For the last few weeks, we have been consumed by hurricanes. Harvey made landfall on the Texas coastline on Friday, August 25th. That day, President Trump signed a directive reinstating a ban on transgender people in the military and pardoned the controversial Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio. Those moves did not get as much coverage as they might have without Harvey and Irma. And using big news to hide other big news is not new for presidents. We're joined by historians Brian Ballow and Nathan Connolly, co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Guys, take us back to President James Buchanan and the Utah War.
Yes, household names all, Jeremy. Right. So James Buchanan, just to refresh people's memory, was elected in 1856, had a pretty unsuccessful presidency. And when he was elected, the territory of Kansas was just coming apart at the seams. There was bloody violence. And it was all over what kind of state was Kansas going to be when it entered the nation. Was it going to be a slave state or was it going to be a free state? Now, Buchanan's own party, the Democratic Party, was split over that very issue. And so Buchanan quite wisely decided he wasn't going to take that on right away. He was going to take on the Mormons.
That's right.
and the reason he was going to take on the Mormons was that everybody in America, or almost everybody in America at that time who wasn't Mormon, hated the Mormons. They endorsed or at least tolerated polygamy, and the acting governor of the time was defying federal agents all the way out in Utah. So Buchanan decided, I'm going to send troops out and get rid of this governor. Now, it never actually came to a military battle, but the nation was riveted on whether the United States of America was going to go to war with the Mormons. And this gave Buchanan some time to do some political maneuvering so that the nation would take its eye off the ball. Kansas is going to be slave or free. And of course, that was the very kind of issue that would lead to the Civil War not many years afterwards.
That's right. I mean, warfare is a really effective way of taking people and reasserting priorities that basically you think you might want, right? I mean, one example that oftentimes gets overlooked, and we've only recently now circled back to it, is the history of someone like Woodrow Wilson, right? So if you think about the segregation of the civil service in the early part of the 20th century, around 1913, they segregated the civil service over a long weekend. Nobody really raised hackles about it because it happened in a very, you know, decentralized fashion, and it was done in secret in part because Wilson was concerned about Northern Democrats and a whole host of other constituents that he had to basically hold together as part of a workable coalition. Now, of course, African Americans at the dawn of World War I were not going to push for desegregation, not in the civil service and not in the military itself. It was a very conscious decision, in fact, to demonstrate a kind of patriotism under Wilson's banner and as great Americans to ultimately go along with what was the segregation statutes at that time. It wasn't until World War II that you really began to saw that push. And so there's a very fascinating problem that many people on the progressive side of the progressive era had to deal with around segregation. And they certainly weren't going to flout someone as popular as Woodrow Wilson at the height of his power.
Okay, let's jump forward to the 1960s and an example involving President Kennedy, who used a holiday to sneak in an executive order. What happened there?
Well, Kennedy, like Buchanan, was caught between different wings of his party. In Kennedy's case, he had made the mistake, he decided in retrospect, of promising to end segregation with a stroke of a pen.
Right.
Right? And so people were so upset that Kennedy did not end segregation with a stroke of a pen. What he meant was an executive order desegregating housing. They were so upset that Kennedy didn't do this by 1962 that they started sending him all these pens. Oh, President Kennedy, maybe you need a pen. Maybe that's why you haven't signed an executive order. At any rate, Kennedy was getting a lot of pressure from civil rights activists within the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. But the Democratic Party then was still very much based in the South. What to do? Well, he eventually did sign that executive order, but he signed it the night before Thanksgiving when people would be focused on
turkey,
you know, turkey and the holidays.
And not the country, the press, right?
Where the press would be taking one of those long weekends. And so it was his way of placating two different constituents. The civil rights activists got what they wanted. Now, by the way, it was a very tepid order, and they weren't entirely happy, but they finally did get their order. Kennedy hoped that not many white Southerners, primarily, would be paying much attention on a long Thanksgiving weekend.
A few years later came another controversial issue, the Vietnam War. How were distractions used in that instance?
Well, you have Lyndon Johnson, who is trying to basically Americanize the war. He's increasing military involvement, and it's increasingly creating a problem for him to find a way to build national morale around creating an American face in this relatively unpopular conflict.
And so Johnson understands that there's a limited tolerance for escalating troops, which Johnson begins big time in 1965, and he gets very worried that a moderate to conservative Democrat, guy in the same party, William Fulbright, chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, is going to hold hearings in February of 1966. What does he do? He creates a distraction. In this case, it was himself. Johnson goes to Hawaii. He takes a lot of cabinet members with him. He has this conference on how he's going to bring economic aid to Vietnam and improve the lives of people in Vietnam. Johnson also meets with his generals over there. And it's Johnson's hope that he's going to be able to distract the nation from Congress, from these congressional hearings. Now, we need to say that one of the problems with distractions is they last only so long, right?
Right.
Fulbright holds hearings. Yes, he starts in 1966. He holds them all the way through the 1970s. He never stops. And, of course, Johnson's strategy of distraction might have worked for that weekend, might have limited coverage a little bit from the Fulbright hearings. But those hearings go on. And, of course, as we all know, the Vietnam War went on.
Right. Well, the last example I want to get to is one that I remember, which involves President Clinton in the 90s. And he had the problem of the Lewinsky scandal.
Right.
And
right.
Some people believe that he did some bombing to distract from it.
So this is one of those examples where it really raises the question of what distractions really are and when a president might in fact be intending or not intending to distract the American people. This is still around the Clinton case, very much an open question. Very quickly, there were attacks on U.S. embassies in Kenya and in Tanzania. And in response, the Joint Chiefs of Staff and Secretary of Defense, William Cohen, basically worked with Clinton to try to figure out a strategy for striking terrorist sites in Afghanistan and in Sudan. Now, the timing of this couldn't have been worse from a messaging standpoint. And so far as there's a very popular movie released December of the previous year called Wag the Dog, which is basically a satire
right.
about presidents who
try
to
move
too.
Yeah.
Right, who try to move the headlines away from, you know, very salacious interpersonal problems and moral scandals with basically raising geopolitical problems for people to focus on. Right. And so through the summer of 1998, as the Lewinsky scandal begins to get to the boiling point, essentially, the question of military strikes is on the horizon. And it's seen as if the Clinton administration is willing to basically engage in a very elaborate military strike to take the country's eye off the Lewinsky scandal. And when you have quotes from Defense Secretary William Cohen, head of the Joint Chiefs, Hugh Shelton, who are saying, like, look, we're not going to move our entire military operation on the whims of a president and his personal foibles, it did not dissuade many in the media and certainly many in the opposing party to cast this as one giant elaborate ruse to essentially, you know, improve the Clinton standing, both in that moment and hopefully for posterity.
So when President Trump launched his airstrikes against the Syrian bases, it was immediately dubbed the wag the dog.
Strikes, not
because President Trump was having a sexual dalliance, as far as we know, but because President Trump's popularity ratings were simply plummeting. And there were those who said, oh, he's trying to distract the nation.
You know, I remember back in the 90s when this happened with President Clinton, I was on Martha's Vineyard visiting some family friends. And he was on Martha's Vineyard as well, and he left to go do the bombings. And the newspaper headlines in the old newspaper boxes, there was the New York Times, and it said, you know, President bombs Afghanistan and Sudan, and the Wall Street Journal said something similar. And then the Vineyard Gazette headline was, President takes quick trip off island.
Right.
It's all local. It is all local.
It's something worth remarking, though. I mean, we are in a moment where, with the president, you know, tweeting, and there's a lot that can happen just in the day-to-day media coverage of the Trump administration, that it feels in some cases that this is a distracting presidency. I mean, many people would be surprised to learn that the president has found a way to reverse or change rules on some 60 different regulations and aspects of American life, including education, the environment, and so forth. And there's only so much that the media can cover on this. But it's also, I think, worth pointing to that President Obama was basically engaging with Trump in part as a distraction as well. I mean, one could argue that the road not taken in Obama's case to possibly respond to the birther movement, which he saw as a distraction, or even Trump himself as a possible distraction, really did leave the space open for Trump to be an ascendant candidate in the wake.
That's Nathan Connolly and Brian Ballow, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Guys, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
And now to that controversy centered around ESPN SportsCenter host Jemele Hill, who tweeted out that President Trump is a white supremacist who has largely surrounded himself with other white supremacists. Here's White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders responding yesterday.
I think that's one of the more outrageous comments that anyone could make, and certainly something that I think is a fireable offense by ESPN.
Well, former baseball star Curt Schilling said about the same thing on Sean Hannity's show. Schilling was fired by ESPN in 2016 for retweeting an offensive post about transgender people. ESPN has not fired Jemele Hill, though. They did call the tweet inappropriate and said it did not reflect the views of the network. Let's bring in Mike Pesca, Here Now sports analyst, host of the daily podcast The Gist at Slate.com. Mike, does Schilling have a point? He was protesting transgender people using bathrooms of their choice. He says Disney, which owns ESPN, supports liberal racism and a double standard. Your thoughts?
Let's talk about the context of Curt Schilling. So he was hired as a former very excellent baseball pitcher to give insight into baseball, and he's actually good at that job. But he also was and had a history of popping off, not just on this one issue. And when we say an offensive tweet, you know, you could look at it. It's a guy dressed in women's clothing and saying your daughters are going to be going to the bathroom next to this guy. Before that, he gave a radio interview where he said that Hillary Clinton should be buried under a jail. Before that, and this one got him pulled off of broadcasts, he shared a meme that said 5 to 10% of Muslims are terrorists, but in Nazi Germany, only 7% of Germans were Nazis. How'd that go? Those numbers are inaccurate, by the way, but it doesn't matter. What it means is that Curt Schilling had this history where he was being disciplined and told not to do this, and also his job was to be a baseball analyst, so he was veering from the job. To the extent that he was alt-right before that name became, you know, in widespread usage, and Jemele Hill is classically liberal, or actually that's a loaded phrase. Jemele Hill is liberal. Yeah, they fired a conservative and didn't fire a liberal. But there's another huge difference, and it's Jemele Hill was hired to be an opinion columnist. That was her job at the Orlando Sentinel. She was hired to do opinions on ESPN.com. She got a talk show with Michael Smith called His and Hers, where they were engaged in opinions, and now she's been put in the 6 o'clock edition of SportsCenter, which is their flagship show, but it's clear that she's been told, bring your own personality to it. So it's very different situations.
Well, and she says that this does not reflect the opinion of ESPN, and I'm sorry if my regret is that my comments in the public way I made them painted ESPN in an unfair light. These were my opinions.
Yeah, and then you have the specter of the White House weighing in on it in a way that Sarah Huckabee Sanders, I would note, didn't weigh in on actual personnel decisions she would know about, like the firing of, you know, her predecessor or Anthony Scaramucci or Steve Bannon. He didn't fire. He was quit. But the point is that this has been a huge conflation based on tweets which ESPN really didn't want Jemele Hill to make. In my opinion, since we're talking about analysts giving opinions, I don't think that they were phrased exactly correctly and they could easily be
She says, here's another one. She says, Donald Trump is a bigot. We only have a few seconds. Did she go too far?
I think that's, you know, the Overton window. Like, what's the frame of discourse that's acceptable? And I think for a liberal person hired to be liberal to say Donald Trump is a bigot is one thing. And for a conservative person to put his feelings, if we want to compare it to Chilling, to this is your child, this is who your child's going to be next to in a bathroom, is an entirely other thing.
Mike Pesca, Here Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. And we want our listeners to weigh in at herenow.org. Mike, thanks.
You're welcome.
We've talked about the connection between warming ocean temperatures and stronger storms like Harvey and Irma. Sea surface temperatures have been going up over the past century, and they've been consistently higher over the last 30 years than at any time since 1880 when observations began. So how are rising water temperatures being felt in the deep ocean? Joining us now is Andrew Sweetman, who is associate professor at the Lyell Center for Earth and Marine Science and Technology at Heriot Watt University in Edinburgh, Scotland. He's on Skype. Andrew, welcome.
Thank you very much, Jeremy.
And are temperatures warming in the deepest parts of the ocean, or are the changes in temperature only happening at the surface?
No, there's vast areas of, for example, the Pacific Ocean, where intermediate water layers at around 500 to 600 meters have actually warmed quite significantly over the last couple of decades. And what we're predicting is that with continued CO2 emissions, we're likely to see some of these increases in the deep sea rise by as much as 3 to 4 degrees in certain areas.
What are the effects of that on the ocean floor?
There's going to be a number of effects. Some of the effects include a reduction in body size of the animals. Their metabolism will go up. There will also be a poleward shift of the fauna. And we're actually seeing that in certain parts of the world, for example, in Antarctica, where we're getting invasion by certain crabs on the Western Antarctic Peninsula.
How much life is down at the bottom of the ocean?
A massive amount. And not just in terms of sheer number of animals, but the biodiversity of the organisms is also very, very high. And more importantly, we rely on the services that the deep ocean provides, for example, carbon storage, uptake of heat, nutrient cycling, all of these things that we don't really realize are being provided by the deep ocean, we're actually very, very dependent on. And it's a very, very stable system. So any minor changes in environmental parameters, whether they be temperature, the pH or the acidity of the water, the oxygen concentration or the amount of food that is sinking from the surface ocean down to the deep sea, if there's even a minor change on these, we may see significant impacts at the deep sea floor.
Well, we've been talking about the temperature changes. What about the pH and acidity changes and how those are impacting life on the ocean floor?
Well, in terms of pH, for example, certain areas of the deep sea will be subject to a pH decline of around 0.3 or 0.35 pH units, which is quite significant. Also, oxygen concentrations in certain parts of the ocean will decline. And those types of changes are very, very big changes for animals living at the interface or at what are called oxygen minimum zones. So these are zones in the ocean where the oxygen is very, very low. And at the interface where you come out to the oxygen minimum zone, there's sort of like a zone where animals requiring more oxygen live, situated in very close proximity to animals that don't require that much oxygen. And if the oxygen falls a little bit, it will displace those animals.
And what's causing the oxygen to fall?
Various things. For example, increased upwelling along certain countries due to changes in atmospheric heat. And what happens when you have upwelling? You have lots of nutrients coming up to the surface, fueling primary production or the growth of algae. And then when these algae die and sink to the seafloor, they deplete the oxygen in the water column. Perhaps one of the biggest stresses that's going to occur by 2100 is changing food supply. So across vast areas of the deep ocean, the organisms rely on the trickle down of organic matter coming down from the surface ocean. And what we are predicting is that by 2100, certain areas will lose as much as 55% of their food supply. So you're going to get potentially quite significant changes occurring in an environment that is naturally very, very, very stable. And when you have a very stable environment, the organisms, they're not able to adapt as quickly as, for example, humans to a 1 degree temperature increase. That's fine for us. We experience that every day. The organisms at the deep sea floor, they are not really used to large changes in temperature, oxygen, energy, or pH. And what we are predicting is that by 2100, they will be experiencing massive changes relatively to what they're used to naturally. And this is going to have profound consequences on deep ocean life and the functions and the services that the deep ocean is providing mankind.
Is there any way to reverse this trend?
Oh, that's a good question. That's a very good question. I don't really know. The way climate change is going and the way that we're burning fossil fuels right now, it looks like climate change will continue if we don't stop. But what we can do something about is it's not just about climate change that's going to be impacting the deep ocean floor. By 2100, we're going to be fishing deeper. And we're fishing deeper now. We're potentially going to be extracting minerals from the deep ocean floor. We're going to be extracting, trying to get more oil and gas. So even if it will take a lot longer for us to combat climate change, what we can do is not add even more stresses into the mix by significantly disturbing vast areas of the deep ocean floor through deep sea mining, for example. In the Central Pacific Ocean, the change in food supply by 2100 is going to be potentially around 35%. At the same time, in that area, the Clarion-Clipperton Zone, it's a big area that where they're planning on mining polymetallic nodules. Now, a single mining operation will be disturbing 300 to 800 square kilometers of seafloor per year per mining operation. And just to give you an idea about the area that is being targeted for mining, it's about the size of about 90% of the contiguous United States of America, that area. If you drew a line from, let's say, California all the way to Ohio, that distance is going to be mined in the Central Pacific.
Well, is anybody in your scientific community raising alarms about this and about the health of the ocean floor in general?
Yes, we are. We are. It's a very big topic in terms of deep sea science right now. And there's some really, really great, fantastic people involved in trying to work out what the effects are and trying to advise policymakers, if they are going to mine, how to do it in the best way possible. What we're not able to do right now, and what would be really great to do if we could get funding for this, would be to actually look at the combined effects from, for example, deep sea mining and climate change, or climate change and, for example, an oil spill.
If somebody is listening to this and thinking, you know, we've got a lot of problems here on the surface. We don't need to be worried about the effects down on the deep ocean floor. What would you say to them?
That's another very, very interesting question. Just to give you an idea, the deep ocean provides a lot of services to mankind. So, for example, all the fisheries are along the west coast of the Americas, South America and North America, they are supported by the rich, productive waters that upwell along the western coast of the United States. Now, these are rich, productive waters because of the nutrients are upwelling along the coast there, along up the continental slope and up onto the shelf, and supporting lots of algal production, which is supporting lots of zooplankton production, which is supporting lots of fisheries production, which we rely on. Now, these nutrients that are upwelling, they're actually produced in the deep ocean. So if we disturb the deep ocean significantly, in 100 or 200 or 300 years' time, we're going to start seeing significant effects of what we're doing right now. But it's not just what happens in a couple of hundred years. I mean, deep ocean change, it will be affecting ecosystems that we as humans rely on within my lifetime. So the effects are not so distant from us.
That's Andrew Sweetman, who is an associate professor at the Lyell Center for Earth and Marine Science and Technology at Harriet Watt University in Edinburgh, Scotland. Andrew Sweetman, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Jeremy.
Let's take a trip, get away, to the Colorado-New Mexico border, where there's a remote school that takes adult students back in time to learn how to operate steam-powered locomotives. The Cumbres and Toltec Scenic Railroad runs tourist trains every day, but offers courses for wannabe engineers. Jenny Bruntine from Colorado Public Radio went along for a ride.
What do a sawmill operator, sheep farmer, and software engineer for the Mars space probe all have in common? Awe and respect for a 1925 steam-powered locomotive.
It's a strange beast. It does seem to be alive.
Tom Chenault, the sheep farmer, is from New Jersey.
It's like it's got a heartbeat or something. It's very different from a modern machine you just turn on and off with a key. In order for us to take it out in the morning, someone has to come here, fire it up, get everything oiled up. It's a bit of an ordeal.
Chenault and other students marvel at the steam engine's durability and simplicity. The technology of coal and steam to make power doesn't compare to the electronics of today's workplaces. Ed Lichtenfels is a software engineer, and he says if you make a mistake with the steam engine, you can recover pretty quickly or fix it. Not so with the software on the Maven space probe that he helped develop for the trip to Mars.
I mean, you can do things like patch software and correct for problems, but if you screw something up bad, you can't go to Mars and fix it.
The Cumbres and Toltec is the longest and highest narrow-gauge rail line in the country. There are 7 trips a day for tourists, but this week, one of the engines, 487, becomes a classroom for a dozen men from around the country. It's day 2 of the 4-day session, beginning in the tiny town of Chama, New Mexico. The men will rotate turns in the locomotive in groups of 3 as the train travels 64 miles of steep mountain canyon, climbing to a 10,000-foot pass through alpine meadows and high desert to Antonito, Colorado.
In general, it starts out with a mild amount of terror.
Ed Baudette, the railroad's manager of engineering and operations, says there are also 2 tunnels, 2 long trestles. It's rugged and challenging for the students. He explains that helping the trainees in the locomotive are professional railroaders.
What we're going to do when we release the brakes is let it go back just a little bit, and then we'll give it some throttle. And I'll help you out if you need to.
And as soon as they actually get something moving, the terror tends to go away, and they really get wrapped up in it. They come off all smiles.
One guy drives, one guy keeps an eye on the water level in the boiler, and Andy Taylor, on fireman duty, shovels heavy coal into a blazing hot firebox. Since we're going uphill, it's a lot of work. Taylor says he began lifting weights and running extra miles 9 months before he came here, so he wouldn't
run out of steam, so to speak. So.
Operating what one of the men calls a hulking beast is very physical, but the class is surprised to learn it's also a subtle balancing act, the right mix of water, steam pressure, and heat. Student Tom Chenal says it's the same with driving.
This is loaded with subtlety. The sensitivity of the throttle, the sensitivity of the brakes, they're exquisitely sensitive.
The engineer trainees have to stick their heads out the window a fair bit to see the track and the grade that's coming. John Grigsby is a sawmill operator from Arkansas.
The railroad kind of tells you what speed to go, and you don't have to have a speedometer to tell you that because there isn't one. And as you ride, the railroad kind of tells you what to do by feel.
Railroad manager Ed Baudette says the Cumbres and Toltec line dates back to 1880 and was built to tap the resources of the Rocky Mountains.
This whole operation here is very much a time capsule. It's one of those few places where you can get out of your modern Mercedes or Cadillac and step onto the gravel pavement and look around and think you're back in 1925.
When the men aren't in the locomotive, they ride in the boxcars and compare notes.
How'd it go?
It's a fair amount of energy.
You look like you worked up a little bit of a sweat there, yeah.
Yeah. I said, do I look like I went swimming?
Yeah.
Many of the men say they had model trains as kids. They like learning about new machinery, and they're drawn to a machine that uses all of a human being's senses, something that's been lost with modern-day technology. Chuck Turner is a software engineer for a sawmill in Oregon. He says a lot of operating a steam engine is listening.
It's like, hey, that part's a little loose there or something, so I'm kind of into it at that level, too.
Tom Chenal will soon return to tending his sheep in New Jersey. For him, this engineering class is partly about tracing the roots of how we got to where we are today. For Here and Now, I'm Jenny Brundy.
Train, train, train. I've got a thing about trains. I get a sad kind of feeling when I see a passenger train in this fast-moving world.
Johnny Cash, Because We Can. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Did he talk about the quiet car in this song? I don't think so. It's Here Now.